Welcome to Body Signals, a Cygnos podcast. I'm your host, Bill Tanser, the Chief Data Scientist here at Cygnos. This is Season 5, Episode 2, Finding Metabolic Wellness, Top Tips from Dr. Paola Cadetti. Join Dr. William Dixon and myself on this fascinating episode as we interview our guest, Dr. Sandeep Paola Cadetti. He's an internal medicine physician and the Chief Medical Officer of the Rebel Health Alliance. In this episode, Dr. Paola Cadetti shares his insights as a primary care physician on how he helps his patients achieve metabolic and overall wellness. During this episode, we discuss how the current sick care model of medicine just isn't working, the challenges of addressing metabolic disease in a clinical setting, and the seven pillars of wellness that Dr. Paola Cadetti uses with his patients to achieve overall wellness. We discuss things like getting lean, getting strong, exercise, sleep, and nutrition, and two areas we have yet to talk about on Body Signals, the importance of community and purpose in achieving overall wellness. Just a reminder, Dr. Dixon and Dr. Paola Cadetti's participation in this show and the opinions they express are for educational purposes only. Welcome back to Body Signals. Before we start, I first want to say we've got Dr. William Dixon back on the show to co-host. Dr. Dixon, how are you doing?
Doing great. Pumped to be here.
We have Dr. Sandeep Paola Cadetti. He is a practicing internal medicine physician, as well as a healthcare executive and an entrepreneur. He's the co-founder and chief product officer of Mishi.co, as well as the co-founder and chief medical officer of the Rebel Health Alliance. And that's a national specialty cloud clinic focused on longevity, wellness, optimization, and metabolic health. Dr. Paola Cadetti, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Bill. Great to be here. Dr. Dixon, great to see you as well.
I've got to ask, I've never heard this phrase, specialty cloud clinic. Could you explain exactly what that is?
Yeah, thanks, Bill. We set out to democratize healthcare in as many ways as we could. And so often, folks are having issues and problems with access to care. Brick and mortar, in many circumstances, is a thing of the past. Of course, we have the need for hospitals and procedures and things like that. But in healthcare, so much of what we do is really relational. It's talking to people, getting a history, understanding the complex sort of fabric of their lives, and making treatment recommendations based on that. So when we went out to create Rebel Health Alliance, we wanted to bring this to as many people as we possibly could. And part of that realization was that by being virtual and by being in the cloud, we could bring this kind of care all across the country. So we are licensed in 50 states now. We offer specialty services in metabolic health and optimization, like you said, and we'll get into a lot more of that. That was really the founding idea behind bringing specialty care in the cloud to as many people as we possibly could.
And when we say in the cloud, we're talking about virtual visits primarily.
Virtual visits completely, 100% virtual here. We have a great team, can talk to you a little bit about that as the episode goes on. All of our interactions with our patients are completely virtual. There are a lot of tools we can use now, and I'm sure we'll talk about that with CGMs and even interesting diagnostics like stethoscopes and blood tests and all other kinds of diagnostics that folks can do even in their home that give us a lot more information, which may not necessarily need to always lay hands on them to get a great diagnosis.
Got it. First, thanks for sending your bio ahead of time. And I noticed in your bio, you said that you were disillusioned with the current sick care model. Wonder if you could just elaborate on that a little bit.
Sure. I've had the great opportunity to practice medicine in some of our country's most storied institutions, and I have great respect for all my colleagues across healthcare. I think Much of our system, however, is focused on fee for service, on volume over value, on treating people once they've already received a diagnosis and they've already become, you know, diagnosed with a particular condition. In 1910, there was something called the Flexner Report, which sought to really standardize medical care across the country. And it was good in a lot of ways, you know, kind of got rid of the quacks and the snake oil and the non-standardized medical treatments and schools that were out there. But what that did fundamentally was put sick care, the treatment of pathology, into the court of medical professionals, into medical school. So much of what Dr. Dixon and I learned in medical school was how to diagnose someone with a condition and treat them with pharmaceuticals or therapeutics that would hopefully stop them from getting worse and in some cases get better. The other side of this coin, though, is salutogenesis versus pathogenesis, which is really the study of wellness and prevention. And much of that was split out and put into the court of public health. And that's important, you know, talking about clean air and sanitation and vaccinations and things like that. But fundamentally, Dr. Dixon, I'd love your opinion on this as well. Most medical schools don't focus all that much time on prevention, on actually how do you talk to patients about being their best selves, about achieving optimal health. We get a little bit more on preventative screenings for, you know, what's the right guidelines, but dietary nutrition guidance, for example, less than 5% or so of board questions and for our licensing exams are focused on that. I received personally less than 5 hours of nutrition training during my medical school training. So that's what I'm really disillusioned with, is we have in one way the most advanced healthcare system in the world, being able to treat people with extremely complex conditions, but that's often too late. How do we actually get in front of that years and decades before a diagnosis happens, while we know all of the pathology is occurring, but they don't sort of meet the criteria? So we tell them, you're fine, come back in a year and we'll just treat you once the number gets bad enough to treat, rather than how do we ever prevent that number from getting bad in the first place?
I think that's totally true. I think there's so much for doctors to learn how to do even before you get any of this wellness stuff. Like, med school is only so long. So the deciding where you place all that time and energy in medical school, and certainly, you know, medical school is not the end of training by any means. Like, I've done most of my kind of preventative and long-term well care after medical school. Becoming a diplomat in the American Board of Obesity and Medicine, for example, was a lot of recall of the nitty-gritty of vitamin metabolism that I had forgotten from the first year of medical school. But I think this is really interesting is just like the volume of patients that are out there is so high. We just have to, like you said, start finding new ways of treating people where they are without, you know, the inefficiencies of being in a clinic, for example, or seeing someone on some random cadence of where they are. I think people are expecting their medical care to be a lot more online, both in terms of the internet, but also, like, you know, they need answers and they trust certain people to get them. And then, like, at the end of all this, like, we can't diagnose so much. Like, I think this was the most amazing thing to me of the last, you know, of the 10 years that I've been practicing, is people come to me and I have every single test in the world basically at my disposal. And some people feel bad and I can't say, this is why you feel bad, like, at this time, which is just still so incredible to me. And that's super frustrating for a lot of people and for me. But now, you know, I think through Cygnos and through a lot of the other discussions I'm having around that, it's really understanding, well, it's stuff that we haven't considered as pathology necessarily, that is additionally making people feel bad. So I feel like we're learning so much still about how to be not sick as opposed to just, you know, how to cure things that we can easily point to.
Amen.
Yeah. And in that line of thought, I was watching some of your videos, Dr. Policodetti. You've got some amazing videos you've posted to YouTube on your channel. And for listeners who want to go and listen to some of the videos that I'm going to reference in today's podcast, just go to YouTube and type in Rebel Health Alliance, and I think the channel will come up and you can play some of these videos. But you made a really interesting point about primary care. And I hadn't heard this stat before, but you had mentioned in one of your videos that a primary care doc typically has like 2,500 to 5,000 patients that they carry. I've seen other studies on the amount of time that a primary care physician has with a patient, and I've seen a range anywhere from like 10 to 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. One study that was relatively recent said of that time, only about 5 minutes is spent with the doctor talking. In that exam for a primary care visit. So I'm curious, when we get to something like metabolic disease, we've got, you know, 40% of the population that's obese, 30% overweight. How does a primary care physician address all the issues around metabolic conditions within a primary care setting?
Well, I think they don't, Bill. And that's with all love and respect to my primary care colleagues. My father is a family physician for 40 years. That's who I primarily learned from. And I practiced as a primary care physician in the system, having a panel of 3,000. And you're right, the stats that I've seen are somewhere around 7 minutes is the average amount of time that a physician gets to talk with a patient. And of that, how much of that time in the back of our minds are we running through the checklist? Like, oh, I've got to get this person their colonoscopy. I really need to make sure that their insurance is going to cover this medication. I'm trying to get their, you know, their preventative screenings in order. And we rarely have the time to actually sit down and understand the complex sort of story of everyone's life. Every single person is so unique and different. And without understanding where they live and who their family is, what kind of support they have, what their culture is, how they consume information, what they actually understand about their conditions, you can't do that in 7 minutes or even 15 minutes or 20 minutes, in my opinion. Yet that is the standard typical way and the standard feeling that most people have when they walk into their primary care doc. That's why most people feel rushed. That's why they get a quick referral to the specialist so that someone else deals with it. That's why they don't feel like they're heard. There's another startling stat, Bill and Dr. Dixon, that it's something like 30 seconds before a physician in a primary care appointment interrupts the patient while they're sort of telling their story. And it's because we have so much to cover and so many things to do, we just need to get to the point because we got a whole waiting room full of people outside that need our help as well. And so that was one of the founding pillars of why we started Rebel Health Alliance. I spend 90 minutes talking to my patients on their initial visits and 60 minutes with them every month or two after that. I can tell you a little bit more about the clinic, but only in that context do you realize, oh, this person doesn't realize how much sugar is in Coca-Cola, that they're drinking six of these a day, or, oh, this person's culture is very carbohydrate driven, or, oh, this person doesn't feel comfortable sort of opening up to someone who looks and sounds like me. There's so many different aspects to human relationships. And that's what these are. Primary care physicians, you're asked to understand the most intimate parts of how someone's life is all operating. So unfortunately, part of the reason that we see those statistics, like you mentioned, 7 out of 10 people being overweight or obese, 7 out of 10 people having prediabetes or diabetes, it's because the system is fundamentally just set up to treat quick illnesses. And in my opinion, most physicians and patients are really the widgets, the cogs in the machine, right? The payers are the ones that are pushing folks into the system and paying for that care. The health systems are the one rendering that care. And the economics just don't work out when you kind of use the standard fee-for-service mechanisms that we have today.
It's such a challenging problem. And I can back this up with my own personal experience. And one of the reasons I joined Cygnos as a co-founder is I went to my primary care physician. This is now going back 4 years. And it was a concierge service. So he had more time than 10, 15 minutes, spent maybe 30 minutes with me. But I remember him coming right into the exam room, looking at my labs, and he said, okay, you have all the elements of metabolic syndrome. You're hypertensive. You've got a high LDL. You've got a low HDL. You've got high triglycerides. And so he went through the whole list. You got it all. He said, you've got to lose weight. That's where I would start if I were you. I said, okay, doc, well, you have any suggestions? And he said, I don't know. Go to the bookstore. There's a whole aisle of diet books. Pick one that you like. Lose some weight. And that was in a concierge setting. So I can understand just how challenging that is for a physician, a primary care physician on the front line, having to navigate all the things that we've learned at Cygnos go into helping someone achieve metabolic health.
With burnout as well, right? No doctor goes to medical school hoping that they're going to spend 5 minutes with the patient. We all remember those moments where we sat down with patients and had two or three patients because we were just a student and got to spend an hour with them and learn all about their lives and know their dog's name and know what their kids are doing and understand their life deeply. And it's not to say primary care docs don't find ways to figure out that information, still form deep relationships. I want to be clear, I have a lot of love for a lot of PCPs, but the system is not set up to help us succeed. And that's why we're seeing doctors leave healthcare in droves. There's a recent study that polled medical students, and only 25% of current medical students think they're going to practice full time. Most of them want to do other stuff and learn medicine and maybe take that and start cool companies like Cygnos, like Rebel Health, perhaps. But very few medical students and trainees are going into medicine to practice full time because they see it all over the face of all their attendings, how stressed they are, how busy they are, how they're not able to give the time that's required to really deeply understand someone and make real impact in their lives.
Yeah. I really want to focus in on the metabolic health aspect because I think it seems like one of the more complicated areas, and it's something that both of us are trying to address. So I'm wondering how you're using CGMs in your practice today.
We use CGMs for a variety of different patients. I'd say the most common archetype are pre-diabetics, people who are not yet diabetic. They're not on insulin. They're not the typical folks who are, needing to really monitor their sugars and make sure that they're administering the right dose of insulin. To me and to many of our patients, the data is one of the most powerful motivators for change. Understanding what's happening in your body in real time has completely shifted people's understanding of what they're doing and what they're eating and how they're going about life. I have patients all the time who say, oh man, I didn't realize that eating all these starchy vegetables and this rice and this followed up by ice cream was going to spike my blood sugar to 200. And I saw that for the first time and it scared me. And I started to change my behavior. So many of my patients see postprandial blood sugars, which you should spike, right? That's a natural body's response. And I think there's another side to this where we need to be careful not to push too much sort of anxiety around these things because there are natural ebbs and flows of blood sugar in our bodies. When we're working out, we should have that burst, right? We need that in our bodies. But to see what certain types of food do at different times during the day, to realize, oh, I'm spiking, but if I go on a walk after every one of my meals, I see it just tamp down and come down back under 100, and it's nice and steady after that. To show folks that, you know, perhaps if I am eating more protein and lean, you know, lean meats and healthy carbohydrates to start my day rather than cereal and jelly, I can feel the difference in my body, and I see that play out in the data. And so we use all sorts of diagnostics. For most of our patients, we get very deep blood work. We understand more than just your typical A1C and lipid panel for the year. We get a genetic panel, which I'm happy to talk to you about. We get DEXA scans on almost all of our patients because we want to understand how much subcutaneous fat you have, how much visceral fat you have, which is causing all sorts of inflammation in people's body, which is highly correlated to mortality and morbidity. And those data points often are the wake-up call. It was for me. You know, I was 50 pounds overweight at least, and it was a long, decades-long sort of march there as I went through training and just didn't focus on my own health. And I have a strong family history of diabetes. Both my parents have diabetes and two of my grandparents have diabetes. And I wore a CGM. And for the first time, it gave me the insight to realize what was actually happening in real time. I got a DEXA scan. I was like, oh man, I am way over where I need to be. And so we use it predominantly for folks who are kind of teetering on the edge, who need a little bit of a reminder that these things aren't something that's going to happen 10 years and 20 years from now. There are damages, there's microvascular damage occurring right now. There's glycosylation that's happening right now. And you can see it in real time if you have the right kind of tools around you. So I love what you've all built at Cygnos. I love the idea of more people using CGMs. I think it's interesting sometimes in the Twitter sphere and social media and everything to kind of see some doctors dunking on it. Like, you should never wear a CGM if you don't have diabetes. I completely disagree with that. And Dr. Dixon, I'd love to hear your opinion. I'm sure I can guess where you stand on that, but I do think it's almost borderline irresponsible to not allow individuals to understand the physiology that's happening in their body when we have the tools to do so. And in my opinion, we're never going to stop the march forward of technology. And in 10 or 20 years, I think some of these things will be ubiquitous. You know, maybe they're built into the Apple Watches or whatever, but now people will start to have this kind of data, and we're going to have to understand how to coach people and guide people through it.
I agree. I think almost everybody should wear a CGM for at least a little while. And certainly if someone is already getting to the point where they're being actively screened by a PCP for diabetes or metabolic syndrome, like, I think there is some good data that shows that CGMs are much more predictive of future diabetes. Like in adolescent populations, they've even done studies that show that it's better than an A1C or fasting glucose for predicting future diabetes. I think you're right in saying that if it is causing you undue stress to knowing all this information, in terms of your, like, you know, glucose data rolling, then yeah, because stress is also bad. So, you know, what's nice about what this CGM is, you, if it's causing too much stress, you just take it off. You don't have to have this information if you're not using insulin. But I do think that just, you know, the absence of knowledge of the glucose state does not mean it's still not happening in the background, right? How often have you seen a patient where they come in and they're like, this is crazy, I've been healthy my whole life and now my A1C is 11. It's like, well, guess what? You know, you haven't actually been healthy your whole life. You just didn't know that you were sick. And so I think if you are taking this data and providing one, some knowledge about how it is impacting your health and good or bad, right? Like, we don't want people to only eat bacon and cheese because that doesn't impact your glucose data, but is like nutritionally barren, you know, not to say, I don't have anything against bacon and cheese specifically, but if you only ate bacon and cheese, like, that's not a good diet. But with a little bit of knowledge, and I think even more importantly, like, how do you, if you just watch your glucose numbers go up and down and you were like, oh, I don't know what to do, this is so scary. But it, like you said, if you get this simultaneously with an educational program, coaching, you know, the kind of things where you like can see it change in real time. And for the first time, you actually have the ability to impact your physiology and then see the results as you're doing it. Like, that is so cool. On a day by day basis, you're like, wow, I feel better. And this is why I know I feel better, or wow, I feel bad. And I haven't done, you know, a workout in a week and my numbers are, you know, going up and going down like crazy. And then you do 20 minutes of weightlifting and then all of a sudden you're a straight line for a day. Like, it's so cool to see that happen, where you can really, I think, positively reinforce good behaviors. So I agree that, you know, there's probably some people out there who this is not a thing that will be good for them. But I do think for a lot of people, at least a little bit of time trying one is crucial.
I agree.
You both said such great things. And I just want to like third some of the things that you're saying. That immediate feedback loop, it was so life-changing for me as well. Just being able to see that there are things I can do to control what my glucose level is. Like Dr. Palacadetti, when you said, you know, just get up and take a walk, or Dr. Dixon, go and do some weightlifting and you can actually change your graph. Or if I maybe change what I'm having for breakfast, I can totally alter my graph. It was really interesting. It caused like a mindset shift for me, where going back to that doctor visit, just lose weight. It was like, ugh, just felt like deprivation, right? I'm going to have to deprive myself of food in order to get healthy, to this new mindset, which is, wow, I have control over what's happening, some control over what's happening in my body with my glucose, and I can make these little changes. And wow, I can actually see in real time how those changes take effect. So it is so powerful. And I also, some of those influencers, even MD influencers online, that are saying nobody who's healthy ever should wear a CGM, I can't disagree more. And I think some even say if someone doesn't have, if they're not diabetic, they shouldn't be wearing a CGM. I can't disagree more. What about, you know, the 30% of the population that is overweight, and the 40% that are obese? They may not have diabetes, but man, they could probably make so many little small changes to help get to metabolic wellness if they had this data.
Yeah, it's no different to me than any other vital sign like blood pressure. Would we ever tell someone, don't check your blood pressure? Right. We've diagnosed you with high blood pressure, and only we are the ones that are allowed to tell you that. No, that's crazy, right? Like, we would say, check your blood pressure and make sure that you don't become hypertensive.
Yeah.
These things you can do to prevent that and to have that data and understanding about your life. So I don't know how and when that sort of happened. I think one potential explanation for that is that doctors don't have the time and the space to have these nuanced conversations, right? And so they see it as an annoyance and a nuisance, like, oh God, someone's coming to me with this log of blood sugars. Now I got to figure out what to do with it. They don't have diabetes. And here I've got my other 10 things on the checklist that the health system's going to yell at me if I don't talk to them about. So I get it to some degree, but that's still not appropriate. In the ideal setting, if we all had a team and the time to actually talk to patients about what these numbers meant, even if there was some anxiety, Dr. Dixon, I agree, but you can allay a lot of those fears if you have the time to talk to someone about what this actually means, where, okay, they're freaking out because their blood sugar spiked when they were working out. You have the time to describe the physiology of why that's important and why your body needs that sugar at that time. And I just think, in the milieu of 1,000 other things going on, a lot of these clinicians don't know how to interpret that data. So they tell patients not to do that, which
I was listening to, ironically, a different podcast earlier today about the rise of anxiety in America and specifically in the teenage population. And it's an interesting, anxiety is part of the human condition, right? You are faced with something unknown or in a situation where you are not sure. And anxiety makes sense in that point, but anxiety cannot be the destination. It has to be part of the journey. So you have to push through this anxiety thing if the destination is something worthwhile or useful to you. And so that's kind of, I totally agree. Like, it is okay to have some anxiety about stuff, but if the outcome is that you learn a lot about, you know, what makes you feel good and healthy long term, I think like that is a reasonable journey to take.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to shift gears a little bit and talk about a video that I found on your YouTube channel, Dr. Palacadetti, that I found fascinating. And it was your seven pillars video where you walked through some of those seven pillars of wellness. I was so interested in it because we have our own view at Cygnos. We usually talk about four pillars being nutrition, movement and exercise, stress and sleep. But you've got seven, so I'm just going to run through a couple of these, or maybe we'll go quickly through all of them just to get your viewpoint on why these are important in a patient's wellness journey. So your first one was get lean.
So study after study shows that a body fat percentage for men, somewhere between 12 and 18%, so around 15%, and around 20% for women, 18 to 22%, is most correlated with improved longevity, decrease in chronic disease development. So I think there's a fixation on things like BMI and weight, and that they're imperfect measures. They're all proxies for what is actually happening inside your body. And so we focus on trying to coach our patients and guide them over months and years to get lean, to get into those healthy ranges where we know that metabolic syndrome, coronary artery disease, hypertension, diabetes, all of these things start to kind of melt away when you're not carrying around all of this excess fat. As you said, 70% of people overweight or obese in this country. It's a startling stat, I think. It's even more startling when you look at our adolescents and our children and realize what's happening to the next generation as well, that it's not slowing down, unfortunately. And we need to understand why. I think that's a whole other topic. But we are often focusing not just on the scale, on the number that you're seeing, but people's actual body composition, because we believe the literature points most strongly to that being the one of the major predictors of downstream success.
And so your suggestion would be resistance training, strength training, weightlifting to increase muscle mass?
Well, both. I want to be, yeah. I think cardiovascular exercise is extremely important. And, you know, we check a VO2 max on most of our patients as well. We make them go through that once a year where they're wearing the mask and they're actually, that's such a great measure, just to say. We might get to that in one of our other pillars here, but it is both. It is losing and shedding adipose, which we know is inherently inflammatory, and visceral fat is sort of hormonally charged and leads to all sorts of different downstream impacts. But it is also gaining muscle, like you said, and that's not necessarily what people focus on. They're just looking at the scale and the weight. But if you're in starvation and you've lost 50 pounds and 30 of those pounds are muscle and 20 pounds are fat, have we really done you a service there? Perhaps it got you head in the right direction and now you have less pain in your joints and you can move more and you're more active. That's great. Maybe we start there. But, you know, I don't, at least not right now. I don't want to get too much into some of these GLP medications and everything, but I do worry at some point that by essentially pushing people into starvation mode, we are causing too much muscle mass loss. What we should care about is body composition overall. And again, right. That 15% or so for men, around 20% for women, to me, to my read of literature, seems to be the most correlated with improvement of chronic disease.
So a question for you. I was actually just visiting with my own primary care physician, and he was looking at my DEXA scan because I went and got one as well. And he said, okay, you're doing well, but he's like, you know, you're 57 years old, probably not go below 15 to 20%. So don't go crazy on this. And I think that's a point that we don't hear very much, that, you know, fat actually does serve a purpose. It's an energy store, and there might be, well, getting lean is definitely that we hear so much now about the benefits of additional muscle. To Dr. Dixon's point about, you know, smoothing that curve, it's like a glucose sink, kind of sucks up a lot of that excess circulating glucose. But is it true that there's a lower bound that you wouldn't want your patients to get below in terms of their body fat percentage?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not sure where 15 to 20% or that number sort of comes from. The data that I've seen is really in the single digits. And, you know, once you get to 8, 6%, then absolutely you're causing all sorts of impacts on hormone genesis, on sort of metabolism at large. People get cranky and irritable, and there's all sorts of problems for having too low of a body fat as well. That's why things like anorexia and bulimia can cause life-threatening conditions if you've gotten to that low of a body fat percentage. I just think that that's not the problem most of us are facing, unless you're in sort of a eating disorder clinic or a pretty stark situation and you're doing global health or something like that. We have an excess of calories available in this world and certainly in our country. And we rarely see people in my practice. I don't have a single patient that is in single digits in their body fat percentage. So I think I would be cautious about that. And that's why we do serial DEXAs and we watch people as they are on their weight loss journey. If they're getting down to that 10 and 8% range, you know, some of these bodybuilders that are going out there to compete, when you're seeing every single little muscle popping out, yeah, they might be at 7 or 8%. But if you really talk to them, they're not feeling great. They're not at their peak physical form at that moment. So I certainly think there's a lower bound. What that is probably debatable. Single digits, I'd say, is where you should start to really think about it. But under 12 or so for men, under 15 to 16 for women, that's probably where you'll start to see some of those downstream impacts, especially on hormones and neuroendocrine conditions there.
Got it. Second pillar, get strong. I kind of see them both together. So maybe you could differentiate for us the difference between get lean, get strong.
Totally. I mean, we can maybe even take the third one together as well, because they all are around exercise, essentially. Right.
And the third one is move more, right?
Yeah. The American Heart Association just put out a great scientific statement on resistance training. They reviewed all the literature over the past 10, 15 years, and they go through point after point after point of, regardless of your body fat percentage, having more muscle improves hypertension, improves glucose, improves hyperlipidemia, improves hormones, improves functional ability more than anything. Like when we talk about longevity and optimization, none of us want to be 70 or 80 in a wheelchair, barely hanging on and stuck in a nursing home, right? We want to have vitality. We want to be hiking the Rockies with our loved ones. We want to be going to our granddaughter's wedding and being able to dance with her, right? Like that's what being alive really means. And if you follow the, you know, Peter Attia's and Huberman's of the world, when they talk about health span, that's really what it is. It's those marginal decades of your life. How can we ensure that we are independent and we're able to do even basic tasks? like lift something, our groceries up and take them into our home by ourselves without assistance. Those are the kind of things that are going to keep us healthy and well and independent. So forget about body fat for a second. Having enough lean body mass, having muscle to actually do the things that you want to do in your life. We're not pushing everyone to go compete in CrossFit or Ironman or whatever. That's fine if that's your aspiration, but even putting on any muscle in general. And I think I've seen some stuff recently that, you know, if you're over age 50 or 60, you shouldn't be doing weightlifting, which has never been proven in any study, to my knowledge, to be detrimental. Of course, there's going to be injuries and you need to do it under guidance and do it in the correct way and have form. We have a trainer on our team. Every patient gets hooked up with a strength and conditioning coach, and many of them show videos to our trainer and say, I've never done a squat in my life. Am I doing this right? And he'll give them guidance on how to adjust themselves. But getting strong is about being independent for as long as we can. We are probably all losing somewhere on the order of 5 to 10% of our muscle mass per decade, even if we are staying active and healthy. So the things you're able to do now, you're not going to be able to do 30, 40 years from now. The more you kind of build that tank up, the higher chance you're going to have of functional independence later on in life.
Moving through these, there was Move More, which is, I guess, the cardio aspect.
It is the cardio. And I think it's silly to me that someone would ever suggest only doing one or the other. If I had to pick one single data point that I think is most predictive of mortality and morbidity downstream, it is VO2 max. It's a measure that takes into account almost every organ system in the body, certainly cardiac, pulmonary, vasculature, but ultimately what is testing is your mitochondria's ability to utilize oxygen in milliliters per kilogram per minute. So what that tells us is many things, but the data is very stark and clear on this. Here's a stat. So if you're a lifelong smoker, your chance of death over the next decade versus someone who is never a smoker is 40% higher. Your hazard ratio is 1.4. If you are in the low category of VO2 max versus the elite category, you have a 400% chance, higher chance of death or comorbidity than someone who is in that well-trained sort of state. And we will all lose our VO2 max and our cardiorespiratory fitness over time. If you have a VO2 max of 20 or 30, you're struggling to walk up a flight of stairs. Even walking up a slight incline is challenging. You literally do not have the cellular and metabolic components of your body to be able to execute that task. So again, when we talk about health span and having vitality in our later decades, we don't want to be huffing and puffing just walking from the car back to the house, or even able to do that if we're lucky, right? We need to be able to sustain that. And again, it's about 10% per decade. So if you're 40 and your VO2 max is 40 right now, by the time you're 80, you're looking at something in the mid 20s, which is, again, you're going to have trouble even climbing a flight of stairs. No one thinks that that is worth living for. That's not what we're talking about. So we coach all of our patients to focus on both cardio training as well as resistance training. We check VO2 max when it's safe and when people agree to it at least once a year. And we want to see that number continue to rise. So that's what we mean by moving more.
Got it. We're hearing more and more about VO2 max these days, especially since Apple Watch is estimating your VO2 max. Do you have any viewpoints on whether or not that estimation's good, or if does someone need to go on a treadmill with a Metcart and get that true test?
I think that there's interesting new diagnostics. You know, what VO2 max, like when we talk about going into zone two and zone five training and things like that, it doesn't need to be crazy. You know, zone two training is 60 to 70% of your max heart rate, but that's really when you start going up on this lactate curve. And so they're now actually continuous lactate monitors, which I'm curious if you all have thought about it or if you've considered with Cygnos, but I think it could be a really cool add-on to that, especially for people who are quantified selfers. But zone two, 30 to 60 minutes a day, and zone four to five once a week is all it takes. There's something that we talk about, the 4x4x4 split, which is 4 minutes at about 90% effort, so 90% heart rate, and 4 minutes off, and do that four times. So 32 minutes a week, and you're out of there. And you are really training up your VO2 max. The Apple Watch, in my opinion, is one of the worst measures of it. I've seen so much variability on that. In almost every circumstance, I've seen the Apple Watch undercall someone's actual VO2 max. I tried to do some digging, and I think I found the study they based it on, which was something like 10 well-trained males that they used the calculation on. So my opinion is that you actually need to go in and do the hard treadmill test. You can do it on a bike. You can do it on a rower. Take somewhere around 12 to 15 minutes. Certainly uncomfortable. Like, I don't know if either of you have done it. It doesn't feel great, but it gives you such amazing information back. And again, it's one of these things like a CGM that it's like, okay, wow, I have this data point now that locks me against, you know, a normal curve or at least a population curve. And I know my mortality is literally doubled or tripled. And it doesn't take much to cut that risk either. By even just moving from the low category to the moderate category, you cut your risk of death and disease in half. Just by doing that. So we're not saying you need to be an Olympic sprinter or be able to run a marathon, but to be able to walk around your neighborhood for 60 minutes without getting winded and once a week to put some effort in, that is something I think most of us should be striving for.
Absolutely.
It's wild to me how little like high zone five, whatever, how little actual minutes you need to do that per week for like maximum effect. Like you said, it's like 16 minutes is like, totally. And that's enough. And like people, I just can't wrap your head around that. Cause I feel like you grew up thinking you need to be running 3 hours a day for it to even be worth it to start. But like a minute of jumping jacks after dinner, like, you know, every day it's a minute, you know, when you're waiting for your coffee, drop down and do pushups. Like that's, you know, that all counts.
Yeah, we've talked about on the podcast this idea of exercise snacks, that there have been some studies of just doing a minute or two, getting yourself into that zone four by running up and down your stairs. You know, just doing it once or twice a day can improve your VO2 max as well.
Yeah, I think we overcomplicate it. People make excuses. We make excuses for ourselves, right? It's a whole thing to go to the gym and it's going to take me 2 hours. I don't have time. I'm a busy doctor, executive, or whatever we are, right? But our modern lives have just made comfort the norm rather than the anomaly. And even by doing the smallest little things, I love that term, the exercise snacks. It doesn't take anything more than 2 or 3 minutes. And if you can stack that up a few times during your day, like you said, William, you're starting to get cumulatively the kind of impact that you're looking for in your life. And you know, we tell patients all the time, you know, choose the far spot in the parking lot. Don't drive around three times looking for the closest spot. Like enjoy those moments of just walking to and from the store. Take the stairs. It's one flight. Just do it, right? And those kind of things, I'm not sure people realize have as big of an impact as they actually do until they're on the other side. And it just become a way of life then.
Yeah. there's so many great things, and I've heard that a lot. That's something I've tried to do. I'm fascinated watching at my local Equinox gym the people that are trying to get the spot closest to the gym to go walk in and get on a treadmill. I never quite understood what's going on there. Exactly. Moving through the pillars. Your fourth, sleep well, which I'm so glad to see that. We had Dr. Sunil Kolawat on from UCSF not too long ago, and he's an endocrinologist, metabolic endocrinologist, and he was telling us in his belief, sleep is probably second after nutrition in terms of importance for metabolic health, and we definitely see that in our data. So I don't know if you have any quick tips or thoughts on the sleep pillar.
Yeah, I would argue that it's almost number one, frankly, because it all starts with sleep. We all know what happens when we have a terrible night of sleep. There's studies that show our willpower is down, our ability to push ourselves to make the right decisions on exercise or nutrition, and it all kind of spirals from there. So I won't repeat probably everything that he said in that podcast, but one thing I do think is important is our consumption of blue light and how much that impacts our circadian rhythms throughout our day. And again, our modern modern times is we all sit in bed and scroll whatever, or we're watching TV to help us fall asleep. And there's real physiology that's happening. That blue light, that wavelength stimulates something called our suprachiasmatic nucleus in our brain. And that releases cortisol when it should be releasing melatonin. And we don't realize the importance of sort of limiting that. We talk to patients about the 3-2-1 rule all the time, which is 3 hours before bed, try to make it your last meal. Having that insulin excursion too close to bed causes first a decrease in growth hormone that spike happens in the first 2 to 3 hours of sleep. It also, that first 2 to 3 hours is probably the most important for deep restorative sleep. That's when we get most of our deep restorative sleep. So 3 hours before bed should be your last meal. 2 hours before bed should be no screens. That's definitely the hardest one. At least put a blue light blocker on your phone. My recommendation is read or journal or talk to your partner, or play with your kids, or do 1,000 other things besides binge Netflix and look at your phone, because both physiologically from the light as well as the psychological impact of what those things are doing, it decimates our sleep. And 1 hour before bed, if you have problems with sort of getting up and urinating during the night, we advise people to limit some of their fluid intake, is front load your fluid intake through the day so that you're not kind of getting up and disrupting your sleep there. But you guys probably see this in the data all the time, right? Is poor sleep leads to insulin resistance and a decrease in insulin sensitivity. We see the spikes in blood sugar. Like that was one of the most striking things to me when I wore CGM for a while, was when I got terrible sleep, my blood sugars were terrible the next day. There's nothing else I changed about my diet or my routine. It was all about the prior night's sleep. And again, to give people that real-time data to help them understand, look at what's happening inside your body when you doom scroll from 9 to 11 p.m. That's really powerful, and it changes people's behavior completely. And then they see it the next day when they just read an article or journal or a magazine or a book and fell asleep naturally. Then they kind of plateau and they don't have the spikes. And it's a really beautiful feedback mechanism.
Yeah, and if you want to see that feedback mechanism, an experiment we've suggested to our members, and I'll mention it again here, is try eating the same breakfast every day for a week and look at those nights where you didn't get as good a sleep as other nights and your glucose response to that same breakfast. And most people will see a dramatic difference in their glucose spiking higher on the nights or the mornings after a night of bad sleep.
That's a really good point. It's a good experiment.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. And that was one of the biggest aha was just how important sleep was. You're getting away from, I'll sleep when I'm dead to, wow, this really is important. to my metabolic health, which I think, to your point, it probably is one of the most important. We won't spend too much time on Eat Right because we spend so much time talking on the podcast about the nutrition aspect. But your last two are interesting to me because it differs from our pillars. And I'd like to hear more about community and purpose as your sixth and seventh pillars.
You know, one of the great studies that I love is the Harvard Men study. I believe it's the longest running study in history, and they're on their like second and third generations now of collecting data. And it took two groups of people, Harvard students and inner city Boston kids, and followed them longitudinally throughout their life, collected all sorts of different data points and looked at the development of chronic disease. And it wasn't glucose, it wasn't high blood pressure, it wasn't income, it wasn't education. It was the quality of your relationships in middle age were the most predictive of your propensity to develop chronic disease later on in life. And it's a powerful sentiment when you just step back and think about it, is the quality of our relationships, being surrounded by people who believe things that we do, that love us in unconditional kind of ways, that push us to be our best selves, that hold ourselves accountable. Again, I think so many of the tracking that we see of chronic disease goes with some of the things we see in our modern day age of sort of individualism above all else and kind of social isolation and everyone, you know, going back to they get up, they get in their car, they go to work, they come back, they sit on their screens and that's it. And you ask people, I spend, you know, out of those 90 minutes I talk to patients for in our first visits, at least half of it is on this stuff. It's not about their labs. It's not about their blood sugars or blood pressure. It's about, tell me about your family. Tell me about your community. Do you have friends? Do you have places that you can blow off some steam? These things are not just, you know, woo-woo, like the data is pretty clear, I'd say, that this is one of the most predictive of downstream, again, chronic disease development and mortality. So I do believe having community and however you want to build that in. And I do think social media has a way of building community if done correctly. And even things like what you all are doing at Cygnos, you know, building a community of people who care about their metabolic health enough to look at sort of data and understand what's happening in their bodies, that can be community. But you have to find people that have a similar view that you can just get along with and do things outside of your current scope that pushes us in so many different ways. And again, literature would suggest it's very clear that that has real impact on our lives and our health.
And on purpose, your last pillar, I'm really curious as to where you see that fitting in to your care.
Purpose tracks with community, I think. But when we think about people who are not doing well and kind of engage in self-destructive behaviors, and this isn't universal, but I'd say, you know, substance abuse is a good example of that. There are definitely functional alcoholics. I'm sure we know all sorts of people who are very successful that have certain habits, but I'd say it's probably the minority of people like that. When you have something you are relentlessly focused on, when you have a reason to exist and be in this world, you want to feel your best. You're not distracted. You're not trying to escape things. You are trying to optimize yourself in a way that allows you to pursue that purpose because you feel like you're meant to be here for that. I don't know what your all personal purpose is. I'd say most of us in healthcare are here for a purpose because we believe we can do good in this world by helping people feel their optimal selves, by eradicating disease and suffering. Like, that is something worth getting up for every single day and something that gives me accountability in all the other decisions I'm making in my life. So we talk about that with patients all the time, is what's important to you? You know, are you happy in sort of what you're pursuing? Because how much of metabolic disease do we see in people who just hate their lives, right? Like they hate their boss. They're in a relationship they don't love. They don't really have something they're pursuing. They don't have no agency over their own lives. It plays out physiologically in how they're sort of doing in their metabolic health as well. So we encourage everyone. We all have unbelievable talents. Every individual has something to contribute in this world. It's our job as we go through life to figure out what that is and to pursue that with relentless, you know, dedication. And usually what follows is an improvement in all other aspects of your life as well.
Well, very well said. We're running out of time. I can't believe I've got like two more pages of questions for you. So Dr. Palacadetti, we've got to have you back on to the show.
Episode two.
Before we let you go, though, if you could just let people know how they can find you, if they want to find more information about you, Rebel Health.
Yeah, rebelhealthalliance.io. We are, again, a specialty clinic in the cloud. We hook everyone up with a nurse wellness coach, a dietitian, a strength and conditioning coach, an epigenetic coach, a physician like myself. We go deep on the diagnostics. We spend time with you. We have panel sizes less than 100 patients so that we can actually care for you in the way that you need to be cared for. So rebelhealthalliance.io, you can find out all about the practice. You can follow my rants on Twitter at Dr. Deep MD. I'm on LinkedIn as well and not very active on Instagram, but you know, certainly Twitter, I think, is quite the melting pot of ideas and a good place to sort of exchange a lot of different viewpoints. And so I find myself gravitating there, but would welcome the opportunity to chat again with you both and go deep on another set of topics here, and really appreciate the opportunity to expand on some of the work that we've been doing and some of the viewpoints that we have.
Well, I really appreciate you having you on. Dr. Dixon, always great to have you on as co-host and having your insight. So Dr. Palacadetti, hopefully we will talk again, but thanks so much for being on Body Signals.
Great to be here. Thank you, Hal.
Thanks for joining us on another episode of Body Signals. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe to our feed. Also, please share this episode with your friends. For those of you who are not yet Signos members, go to signos.com, signos.com, and use the code BODYSIGNALS, all one word, to get your 15% discount on Signos. We look forward to seeing you on our next episode of Body Signals.